Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
Gentlemen, we are tonight's entertainment.
Good evening, everybody. It's John. You're here with Punch Drunk Critics on Punch Drunk Critics Live, Sunday night, 7 o'clock. Thank you for joining us. We've got as usual, I feel like I say the same thing every damn week, that we have a lot of great movies to talk about, what we do, and it usually does, because we pick the good ones to talk about, let's be honest. Travis, how are you doing, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm all right. It's been a weekend. Went to a haunted house. Got Halloween going, right? Other than that, just not too much.
Nice. Yeah, it's been kind of a quiet week here for me, so I'm kind of happy about that. I need a break. Got a lot of stuff coming up in the next few weeks, so it's nice to just kind of hang around the house a little bit for once.
No doubt.
So... But speaking of Halloween, we got a horror movie this weekend, The Sinister.
Yes.
The next film from director Scott Derrickson, who gave us The Exorcism of Emily Rose a few years ago. We also got Argo, Ben Affleck's new film, and Seven Psychopaths, the next film from Martin McDonagh. This is a lot of follow-up films, and actually it's kind of this week is interesting because all these movies are kind of proving boards for a lot of these people. I know Ben Affleck, you know, everybody loves his first two films, but I still get that feeling like people are thinking he's sort of a fluke as a successful director.
I don't know if I'll ever take him. I mean, I think he's the kind of, based on what he's done, I was thinking about this actually when we were watching Argo. As you know, everybody used to always make jokes about him smoking weed while Matt Damon wrote the script for Good Will Hunting. But, right. I think this is a dude that's a lot more serious than people think. And I don't know that he'll ever get the full respect he deserves for stuff. Because has he directed anything that hasn't been good? I can't recall anything.
No. You see, we'll talk about it in a few minutes. But to me, he's 3 for 3. Hmm. But also, Scott Derrickson, you know, he really took people by surprise with The Exorcism of Emily Rose. A lot of people loved it. But then he kind of fell on his face a little bit with The Day the Earth Stood Still. The movie still turned out to be a hit financially, but, you know, in terms of critical reviews, it was kind of in the middle there. So Sinister was sort of a return to where he found success. Mm. And then of course, there's Martin McDonagh, who wowed everybody with In Bruges, and a lot of people were wondering if he was going to be able to, you know, come close to matching that film with Seven Psychopaths. So this is an interesting week in terms of just directors alone.
Yeah, definitely. No doubt. And I think there's also a lot of breakthrough performances this week. You know, we'll talk about one in Seven Psychopaths. And in Argo, you know, Affleck really comes into his own as an actor as well as a director, I think. You know, you get to see a lot of people that are just really good at their jobs this week at the movie theaters. You know, as far as breakouts, I kind of overstated that there. There's only one I can really think of, and that's Sam Rockwell. It sounds funny because, you know, we know he's been out forever, but I still wonder if he's really in the public eye, you know, really where everybody knows about him. And I think as long as this movie does well, and we'll talk about that box office, that people will really start to take notice of Sam Rockwell like they should have years ago.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and start. Let's talk about Argo first. I think this is the most high-profile film of them all. Like we said, this is Ben Affleck's third film. And he does something different this time. He gets out of Boston, shows that he can do a little bit more than just do Boston crime thrillers. Argo is based on it's based on the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis. And while that's, you know, an interesting story in and of itself, the most interesting part, or at least the weirdest part, probably the strangest chapter in our intelligence U.S. intelligence history, was the plan that the U.S. and Canada cooked up to retrieve six U.S. embassy workers who had escaped during the Iranian Revolution, and they were holed up in the Canadian embassy. And what they did was they came up with this. They came up with the idea to craft a fake Hollywood film production for a film called Argo. It's a sci-fi film, and Ben Affleck plays a CIA agent Tony Mendez, exfiltration expert. I was trying to think of the word. It's exfiltration expert Tony Mendez, who comes up with the scheme to come up to make this film production, and so. Knowing that the Iranians are never going to fall for some half-assed plot, they actually I'm here. Can you hear me?
I thought you dropped out for a second. Sorry.
No, I'm here. They actually go through the process of crafting an actual production. That means buying a screenplay, testing actors, and really convincing the Hollywood media to present this thing as a real film, because to the Hollywood media, it was a real film. So it's really an ingenious plot, and one that was very risky, but makes for a very interesting movie, because there's a lot of inherent comedy in there in a fake Hollywood production in a city full of, you know, liars and fakers. So it's very interesting in and of itself.
I think we should also note that you know, of all the based on a true story movies, it's pretty easy to take that with a very, very, very tiny grain of salt nowadays. This movie actually is one of those movies that they actually left stuff out of because you wouldn't have believed it, but it actually did happen in real life. And they actually keep it very close to what happened. And, I mean, really, if we can just think – I just think that's such a stroke of genius, like, to hide in plain sight, basically. Because, let's be honest, there's nobody in the world that doesn't like Hollywood. I mean, we might talk shit about it, but everybody wants Hollywood to come to them. I don't care if you're from, the Midwest of America, or you're Kim Jong-il in North Korea, who is notoriously a Britney Spears fan. You know, everybody likes Hollywood, and they always have, and that's, you know, it's, they went to go through all these other plans. I loved how, not going to get the review too much, but I liked how they told the other plans and why they wouldn't work, like why they couldn't pose. This is really literally the only people that had any reason in the world that was not suspicious to be there were people that were going to shoot a movie.
Right.
And that's crazy.
No, I was actually quite surprised at how many of our critic pals didn't know this is a real, like, this is a true story. Like, I mean, I'm a political guy. I've always found this story fascinating. Mm-hmm. And thought it would make for a great movie someday. So I was always interested when Ben Affleck said he was going to be making this. But I was really surprised by that. I thought it was a bigger, bigger known thing, but I guess not. But,
I figure, especially because a lot of the folks we know, a lot of people that are in this business aren't just big into movies; they're big into the news business. Period. But I'll be honest, I probably wouldn't have known about it except for I've got a bit of a fascination with spies and espionage, so I read about the story a couple times. But it does surprise me that a lot of people didn't hear about that. But I guess it. They don't. They were probably trying not to make too big of a deal when they declassified it.
Right. Well, let's talk about the film itself, though. I mean, I think Ben Affleck, more so than I like the, more so than The Town. The Town is a good film, and I like The Town a lot. I think this film is better. Mm-hmm. Still has issues to me, but I think this film really establishes Affleck as one of Hollywood's top directors. Period. Technically, the film looks beautiful. It's very authentic, down to the details, and I really love that the film, he's not afraid to show that the United States weren't really heroes in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
The film does focus mostly on the United States, although in reality it was primarily a Canadian operation more than anything else. But
how quickly everybody else wiped their hands of a couple of Americans stuck in Iran, but these guys need to risk their life and country just for six people.
Right. The film starts off with a fairly intricate rundown of all the events leading up to the Iranian Revolution. And there's a lot, the United States is very much responsible for a lot of what went down there. They don't come out smelling like a rose, exactly. In fact, we fucked up. You know, that's what I'm going to say. We fucked up. We were assholes. But he's not afraid to show that the Americans weren't exactly heroes in the situation. Now, my thing with it that I have with the, my problem that I have with the film is that I think he has the most fun in the first half of the movie. I think he's mostly enjoying himself when we're actually into the process of crafting this movie. And he's pulling together the pieces along with John Goodman and Alan Arkin, who play, one plays a kind of a washed up producer, and the other one plays a special effects guy. He seems to be having a lot of fun there. And he really focuses on that part of it, because once Mendez gets to Tehran, the movie kind of hits a wall for me. Like, it does, it's not nearly as exciting at that point.
That's interesting, because one of the things, you know, we talked about Ben Affleck kind of coming into his own as a director with this movie, and I think the one thing that highlights that more than anything else, being that it's based on a true story, so, you know, the details don't have to be the same, but the ending is going to be the same. You know what's going to happen, but he still builds this insane level of tension throughout the whole thing.
The first scene when the Iranians are busting through,
my God,
is incredible.
Yeah, I have not seen a horror movie as disturbing as that. I mean, basically what you have is the workers in a U.S. embassy, and you have a riot of Iranians outside, and then the gates break down, or they cut the chains on the gates. And
oh, yeah. They're
basically
beating
just like,
down the gates. They're chopping up the windows. They're doing everything they can to get into the U.S. embassy.
Yeah, and it is really, really tense, really anxiety-inducing. And I think he kept that throughout the whole, especially the final scene in Iran. It was almost, he did something different. I can't put my finger on it. I'm not a great filmmaker, but you can have those will they or won't they know or find out moments. But he did something to add to the tenseness of it. The main thing I had a problem with of the whole movie, and I mean even if they should have taken liberties with this if they could have, is I had a real hard time feeling sorry. Or feeling bad, or identifying with even the six escapees, the people that escaped the embassy before it got taken over, because the people that didn't escape are being held in basements. You know, there's actually a scene where they take some Marines downstairs, line them up like a firing squad, and then click an empty gun at them just to mess with them. And they're in hellish conditions. And then it cuts to the six people that escaped, and they're bitching about not being able to go outside. They're drinking red wine and debating why this is happening. I'm like, and really right. having a feel sorry for me attitude, and that little bit kind of it didn't ruin the movie by any means, but I would have rather empathized with them.
I get what you're saying, and I didn't even really think about that. That looking at it from the larger picture, that there was so much else. I mean, there were, I believe, over 500 people who were kidnapped that day, that were held hostage for months. So when you look at it in a larger context, yeah, maybe it does seem like it's hard to feel for these people. But I thought they did a good job of introducing us to them well enough that you get a little touch of their backstory. You see these little things, because a lot of them were married. I mean, it was six people, and there were two couples out of those six people.
Right.
So you get little hints of some of their personal issues, their little problems that are going on, and I really connected with the guys with the one guy. I think he's played by Christopher Denham, but I could be wrong. One guy who didn't trust Tony, and it's not that he didn't trust him specifically. He didn't trust putting his wife in a situation that wasn't failsafe. Mm-hmm. And I could sympathize with him for that. You know, he felt guilty because it was largely because of him that he stayed there when she wanted to leave. You know, so I could deal with that. I could sympathize with that. But looking at it in a larger context, yeah, I can see what you're saying.
I'm glad you brought up that particular couple. Like we said, there's two couples, and there's a great scene. I think it's him that says it, because it kind of ties in with that, but. One of the two husbands, there's a scene with him, and he's sitting there. I think he's talking to somebody, or he's talking to himself, and he's kind of like, I can't believe I brought her into this. I can't believe I put her at risk. And it kind of really highlights how we operate as humans with the whole, that doesn't happen to me, that happens to somebody else type deal, where, you get so caught up in, oh, this is a great job opportunity, all this. You don't even think where you're at. And I just thought it was great that they highlighted that.
Right.
Also, they didn't really forget the side characters, like the Iranian, maid or housekeeper of the Canadian embassy. They show where her loyalties lie, and then, that's not a big deal. But I thought the really cool thing was that they followed up on her, because no movie ever follows up on the side characters that, are all in as much danger as everybody else.
right? Now, that said, I still feel like there's not a lot that actually happens once he gets to Tehran. I expected, and maybe this is my fault for expecting it, but I think it would have been a better movie if this is what had happened. I feel like they should have spent more time showing Tony trying to train these six inexperienced people to learn how to, you know, act and look like Hollywood filmmakers, because that was what they were there for. If they went through all this time showing us how the production was made, the crucial part was these people being able to pull it off. But we don't actually see him training them very much. We barely see it at all. You know, he kind of pays lip service to it, but we don't actually see it. So, you know, that to me was, I thought that was going to be what the primary goal of the film was showing that part of it. Because I would expect that Tony Mendez would be kind of frustrated trying to train these people to do it. You know what I mean? And them not being able to get it. But that's never what we really got to see. And I thought that was a little disappointing.
No, that completely makes sense. And it actually kind of gives a solution to my one part of the movie that really didn't stick for me. And that's there's a scene where he has to take to keep up the cover. He has to take the escapees to the market square in Tehran to, you know, with the Film Council of Iran, so they actually look like they're scouting stuff. And yeah, it's a very claustrophobic, tense, scary situation. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like it was like they're looking at the script and we're like, oh, well, we got to put this, you know, we have to have a danger beat in here somewhere, so we're going to do that. And now that you mentioned that, that's probably what they took away from was explaining the stories, because these stories, they're given to them one day, and on the next day they have to know these like it's their own life story. Under high stress, they have to be able to, out of nowhere, say who their mother's maiden name was and where she lived. And really all they say is, okay, you're Bob, you're Sue, you're Jill, and you carry a camera and you draw shit.
Right.
but it all pans out in the end. But yeah, definitely I could see what you're saying there.
Yeah. But overall, I really did enjoy this film a lot. And Ben Affleck gets a lot of help from a great cast. John Goodman and Alan Arkin, like I said earlier, they're a lot of fun, kind of poking fun at Hollywood a little bit in the first half of the film. And I really think Affleck gets some fantastic, kind of understated performances by the six hostages. I thought they were all really strong. Taylor Schilling, Clea DuVall, who I've always liked a lot. Mm-hmm. Chris Denham, who, you know, he was in, what was he in? He was in Compliance a few weeks ago, I think. Yeah, he was the bad guy in Compliance. And he was also in The Innkeepers.
Oh, right. Damn, yeah.
He was the guy in The Innkeepers.
Everybody looks so damn different in this movie. And
everybody looks great.
There's actually a prologue that kind of shows, or well, the credits roll, and they show side-by-side pictures. It's uncanny how close they made these people look to the room.
Oh, yeah. Scoot McNairy, who's really like red hot right now. He's in Monsters. He's going to be in Killing Them Softly. Rory Cochran, he's been around a long time. I was really surprised with his transformation as well. This is just, technically, the movie looks great. The makeup is great. All that stuff looks fantastic. Ben Affleck, I think, has really established himself as a top flight director. Like I said, mainly for me, I had some momentum problems with the film, and I wish they had done a better job of not trying to portray the Iranians as bad guys, because they really did. I mean, they really painted them out as one-note bad guys when the situation was a lot more complicated than that. Those people breaking in there were not bad guys, but, you know, that's not really how Hollywood production.
I mean, looking at it, you would assume, you're like, well, what do you mean they're not bad? They're not bad guys. They're tearing the place apart. But I don't think it's possible for anybody in this country to understand the level of stress or whatever you want to call it that they're dealing the level that they're pushed to when stuff like that happens. But I will say, I can't say his name. Ayatollah Khomeini.
Ayatollah Khomeini. Yeah.
He has to be a one note bad guy, because he is the scariest looking MF-er on the planet. If he's still in noise, he died. But he has eyes that like look through your soul. It really freaks me out. But yeah, I mean, all in all, I mean, this I gave this movie a 4.5 out of 5. While I did say there were problems with it, it really the tension that kept up and the historical accuracy, the acting, it even being able to throw a little humor in there with John Goodman and Alan Arkin without making it feel forced was huge for me too. So it gets a 4.5 out of 5 for me.
3.5 out of 5 for me. Very strong film. Another solid effort from Ben Affleck.
No doubt.
All right, so let's move on to Seven Psychopaths.
This is our review of the day, because I am dying to see what we say on this one, because I'm not sure where you're gonna. I know last week when we were on the show, you said you were still thinking about where you were with it. So I really want to see what we come up with here.
Yeah, I ultimately figured out my thoughts on it, but it did take me a few days, and that doesn't happen often. Usually, I know how I feel about a movie right off the bat, but I had to think about this one for a little while. Seven Psychopaths stars Colin Farrell as a writer who's struggling to finish a screenplay, and that sounds like a fairly generic idea we've seen a million times, but he's struggling to write a screenplay. The screenplay is called Seven Psychopaths, which, you know, great title, sounds good, but he can't really figure out how to get it done, how to even really get it started. And part of his problem is that he wants to make the film as nonviolent as possible, which is funny. In fact, he has a Buddhist psychopath in there, an Asian Buddhist psychopath. It's just stupid. But anyway, so looking for inspiration, Marty's friend Billy, played by Sam Rockwell, really kicks off this whole slew of events that start to swirl around Marty. He kidnaps the dog of a violent crime lord played by Woody Harrelson. And that just kind of brings... Oh, he also puts in an ad in the paper for psychopaths to come to Marty's house so he can help inspire his writing. And that brings in all sorts of weird characters into Marty's orbit. And that's kind of where the story goes, kicks off from there. And it's basically Woody Harrelson's guy, crime lord character, trying to find Rockwell, Farrell, and Christopher Walken to get his dog back.
Yeah.
Now this film is interesting, and I'm trying to figure out how best to approach it. In my review, I summed it up as best I could as Charlie Kaufman's adaptation mixed with Quentin Tarantino.
And that is pretty astute observation. That's actually okay. Pretty good.
Okay, because that's really kind of what it is. Now, the film is not straightforward by any means, by any way, shape, or form. It's very meta, and I'm fairly certain that Marty is a stand-in for Martin McDonagh himself. And the film is sort of a takedown of the entire action genre in some ways, and sort of the tics of the genre and things like that, the treatment of women and the silliness of the overtop violence. In fact, the very first scene of the movie is a ridiculous scene starring two characters from Boardwalk Empire discussing violence, ironically, and then something horrible happens to them. So, I mean, the movie is just sort of a takedown of the entire genre, and it kind of folds in on itself in the meta way. But there's a lot of hilarious moments and a lot of weird characters. I mean, Tom Waits is a serial killer who carries around a bunny. There's just a lot of weird stuff that's going on in this film. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it's the cast and McDonough's typically vulgar script that makes me love it, even if I have some problems, and I think it kind of is a little too clever by half.
See, it's kind of surprising you say it, because of the two of us, you tend to like the clever dialogue more than I do. I guess I'm a little too hard on it, but sometimes it just seems like they're trying to be clever for the sake of being clever. This is one of the few movies, and not shockingly, one of the other ones that was like this for me was In Bruges, which everybody should go see, especially if you see Seven Psychopaths and you like it, go see In Bruges. But it was just that quirky, weird, just out there, kind of off the wall dialogue, and you have such different people in every, Colin Farrell and Sam Rockwell in this movie should by no means be friends. they're two totally different people, and they have totally different ways of speaking, and they're both kind of out there. And I really liked all the dialogue. That's why I liked the Quentin Tarantino reference.
Marty strikes me as the kind of person who doesn't have a lot of friends.
No.
And in fact, I think they make reference to that at one point, that he doesn't have a lot of friends. So maybe that's why he's so keen on having, you know, Billy hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that might be part of it. Because Christopher Walken, who's also in the film, has I'm trying to figure out how to describe him, too. Because he's he's kind of bipolar in a way. I guess he's kind of he's violent. You know, you can sense the violence in him, mm-hmm. but he's a guy who's trying to be peaceful, and he's kind of pulling it off. Whereas Woody Harrelson's character is also obviously bipolar, and he doesn't give a shit. He's crying 1 second about his dog, and then the next second he's threatening to kill somebody's wife, threatening to kill the woman who lost his dog. You know, he's kind of all over the map.
Yeah, and that's part of the hilarity of it. And there's a lot of really neat stuff in there too, but stuff that you could almost look into and psychoanalyze if you wanted to. But like Woody Harrelson, it literally at one point is has his gun to somebody's head and says, I'm gonna kill you. And then the guy says, he sees the dog, he's like, don't hurt my dog, don't shoot my dog. Like, right. It's just weird seeing somebody that cares so much about, a puppy. It's so easy to take life everywhere else. But Christopher Walken's character I thought was very, very interesting because there's a whole backstory that you find out as the movie goes through. But he's obviously a guy that's lived through enough violence and so much to the point where he almost comes to a transcendental or transcendent, or I don't even know why I tried to say that word. Another level of understanding where he's like, it doesn't, revenge, getting mad, anything that happens, it doesn't really matter. It takes more time to be mad and get revenge and do all this than to just say, whatever, it happened.
Right. Well, going back to what you said about his response to the dog and his reaction to the dog, that's one of the little things that is kind of a recurring joke in the film. Is that animals are treated far better in action movies like this, or in any movie, than women tend to be.
That is
we
true.
Have two characters. We have Olga Korolenko is in there, and Abby Cornish is in there as a Colin Farrell's girlfriend. Neither one of them barely has anything to say.
No.
And and keeping with the meta theme, they talk about that as well.
Yeah.
That, women don't really have anything to say, and then, of course, the women in this movie don't have anything to say. And then, and going back to the adaptation comparison, we kind of reach a point where Colin Farrell's character and Sam Rockwell's character are sort of playing a game of tug of war, as to where the rest of the story is going to go. Like, Farrell's character is trying to keep it peaceful, trying to keep the conclusion from being just some big grand shootout. And we see, for a while after Billy makes a joke about the film turning into a gay French film or something like that, a gay French art house film, it actually goes that route for about 10, 15 minutes. And it actually looks like that until Rockwell's character kind of gets fed up with it and the film kind of veers off and he kind of takes control. It's very meta. It's very much... I would have sworn that Charlie Kaufman wrote this thing, but no, it's Martin McDonagh. And yeah, it works. It works for the most part. Like I said earlier, I think it gets a little too clever. I think it does hit, some momentum problems after a while, which, is a frequent problem with many films. But in particular, when they start delving into the backstory of all the different psychopaths that Colin Farrell's character has cooked up, I think it veers off and goes a little too deep into that and spends a little too much time doing that and getting away from the actual characters who are in an actual situation. But I think that's probably my biggest problem with it. And that's when I was kind of fighting with myself on. Was like, did those scenes really work? Like, I everything else involving, Farrell and Rockwell and Harrelson and all that stuff I thought was brilliant. But when it kind of went off into its own thing and, like I said, we started going into these other characters, I kind of got disconnected a little bit.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. The movie was, I don't even want to say somewhat disjointed. There was a lot of half-told stories, a lot of stuff that seemed like was just thrown in there. But I think for me, what really put this movie into the stratosphere is the cast. I mean, Colin Farrell it seems like the heavier his accent is, the better he is in the movie. Christopher Walken, I still cannot understand why I haven't tired of hearing him talk or say things, just his general way of being. Like when I'm not spoiling anything because this is in the trailer. When a guy comes up to him with a shotgun, he's like, "Put your hands up." He's like, "No."
Right.
He's just like, "No, whatever. I don't want to." And but really, the star of everything, I think, a real breakout, as I mentioned earlier, is Sam Rockwell. This guy, he really strikes a chord with me in every movie he's in. But this one especially, he's so good at, like, he's such a good actor that he has that little thing where he's a goofy guy the whole time, but you really see in his eyes every once in a while that there is some really psychotic stuff happening underneath. And then he could do that, and then he could deliver lines like the line about the eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. Well, no, the last guy will have one eye. Stuff like that. Maybe it cracked me up. While I could see that it's not a perfectly cohesive story, it was good enough. I had good enough time just watching these guys that I really didn't even notice that much.
Right. Overall, for me, Seven Psychopaths, 3.5 out of 5. I really dug it. I do have some issues with it, but I love the way Martin McDonagh writes characters, and I love the way he writes violence more than anything else, and the way he shows it on screen. It's a little off center compared to the way everybody else does it, and I just think it's a lot of fun. So 3.5 out of 5 for me for Seven Psychopaths,
and a 4 for me for Seven Psychopaths. I guess I just said the whole thing. It gets 4 for me. I dug it. It's probably the best ensemble movie I've seen of the year.
All righty. All right, so last film, and we don't need to spend too much time on this one, and this is Sinister. This is the horror film from Scott Derrickson. Gave us The Exorcism of Emily Rose, produced by the guys who gave us Paranormal Activity, which is interesting because I think this film is better than any of the Paranormal Activities. So they may have outdone themselves. Now, bear in mind, I'm not a big horror guy, at least not these kinds of horrors. So, you know, it's just, you know, take that with a grain of salt. But Sinister stars Ethan Hawke as a crime writer. He delves into true crime stories. Who moves his family into a new home, a home that has been the place of multiple murders and very heinous murders, I might add. In fact, the film begins with one of those murders, the most recent. Captured in a home movie style, the family being hung from a tree, and it's really rather disturbing. I wouldn't be surprised if some people left right after that scene, to be honest.
Yeah, it's something about hanging families. People don't really get down with it.
Yeah, it's a very in your face sort of way to begin the film, and it really kind of sets the tone, I think. But he moves them into this home in order to write a book. About this latest crime. He really needs a hit badly and all this sort. He's kind of a struggling writer at this point. Of course, he doesn't tell his wife that this home was the place of the murder. She does not know this. But anyway, his character goes into the attic and finds a box full of home movies. He begins to watch them and discovers that each one captures a different murder on screen. And these are the murders that took place. All these murders are connected. And then he delves a little bit deeper and discovers that there may be some sort of supernatural aspect to all these killings. He discovers a creature who literally lives within the films themselves. And I think you pretty much know where it goes from there. I really dug this film, and I'm not afraid to say there were a few moments where I kept my eyes averted from the screen. And I don't normally do that. Horror movies don't scare me. They just don't. But something about that creature, the demon that's in this film, really kind of bothered me.
It was the way
they presented him. Now, if you look at him in a still photo, like if you look at my review, there's a picture of him there. He doesn't look all that impressive. In fact, he looks kind of cheesy. But the way they presented him, very quickly, always sort of hidden, he comes out of the darkest of places and suddenly appears, it really kind of bothered me. And I caught myself looking away, hoping I would miss the next time he popped up.
Well, you said you weren't a horror guy and it bothered you a little bit. Don't feel bad. I am a horror guy, and I know a bunch of other horror guys that really thought this was just that scary. I mean, you mentioned that horror movies don't scare you. I think for the most part, or at least I can only really speak for myself, but I would imagine for the most part adults are like this in general, is it I like watching horror movies more out of fun and not some sick twist. I like seeing people get murdered from, but it's just fun to watch to watch the movies, not for a scare really. There's very few horror movies that have actually scared me, and this is one of them. This is definitely one of them, and it is in a lot in how they present him, because the other movie that was a mainstream movie was The Ring, the most recent one, and that it's kind of it's the same but different in the sense that if you look at Samara from The Ring and just see her, you're like, okay, well, she needs to go to a tanning salon, and she's a little bit wet. But no, it's like that jerky movement. Well, they do the same kind of, not the jerky movement, but the same kind of presentation differences make the whole thing. And it tells you how a monster movie, whether you call it a demon movie or a monster movie, the monster is the angel and everything. That's been so many novels.
Mm-hmm.
Get away with having a worse story as long as your main character is badass, and they do that. I mean, it is freaky, the story, and there's a lot more disturbing than just that Gontul,
right?
Whatever his name is, demon. But it doesn't really need to be. It's freaky as it is, and plus anything with kids is just really freaky.
Hold on, my audio is kicking out a little bit. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay, I'm having a problem hearing you a little bit, so I'm not sure if it's me or you. Say something real fast.
Check.
Okay,
check.
No, you sound fine. You sound fine right now. Something about this movie really hit me hard, and I think it was the way they so kind of casually show these murders. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
My wife says your sound is messed up. Anyway, there's something about the way they show these murders that really disturbed me quite a bit. And I'm not sure what Scott Derrickson did, but he has this great grasp of atmosphere and mood more so than anything else. And I think he gets a lot of help from Ethan Hawke, who humanizes the character. I think a lot of horror movies are willing to sacrifice, character development in favor of, a few jump scares, and I think that this film takes a more even-handed approach. Like, we learn a lot about his character, and Ethan Hawke is very good at getting things across without going overboard. Like, we understand his desperation without them having to spell it out for us all the time. We understand the tension between him and his wife and his kids, for that matter, without them having to delve too deeply into theatrics. You know what I mean? You know, that's how horror movies tend to do it, because they think they need to get everything across right now so they can get to the next scare. But I think
right.
This movie doesn't do that, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's effective.
Yeah, you know, I see what you mean. Like a lot of horror movies use it as almost a prerequisite chore that you have to do before you get to the fun stuff, and it shows like that on screen. Ethan Hawke has always been... It sounds almost funny saying he's underrated, because he's been such a big name in Hollywood for so long. But I don't know that he really gets his due. He really doesn't.
Ethan Hawke?
Yeah.
He makes just as much shit as he does good stuff. There's a reason why he's not as acclaimed as he probably could be. For every time he does a Before Sunset or Before Sunrise, God, there was one really awful movie he did not that long ago, and I can't think what it is now.
Is that good or not?
Huh?
I saw it on Precinct 13. Was that good or not? That wasn't good, was it?
I saw it on Precinct 13? No. The remake? No, it wasn't good.
Daybreakers
wasn't good
Brooklyn's
either.
Brooklyn's Finest, that was a horrible movie.
Brooklyn's Finest wasn't very good either. He makes a lot of shit. But when he goes the indie route, and I feel like he does these movies, these Hollywood movies, so he can afford to do these really, these better character indie movies, and that's probably what he does. But yeah, he's really excellent here, and I thought he does a fantastic job. So this is another 3.5 out of 5 for me. So I had three 3.5 out of 5 movies this week. So a solid week of movies as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny that you picked the order of the movies we're going this week, because you went in a perfect descending scale, 4.5 for Argo, 4 for 7 Psychopaths, and a 3.5 for Sinister. But as I always, have a cop-out rating, is my tradition. In terms of horror movies, this is a solid 4, even a 4.5 if you want to talk Halloween horror movies that you should see this year. Because one of the really the things I really liked about it that I didn't mention is that it's able to use kind of the found footage feel, but not be a found footage movie. Like, it can incorporate it into it, and I think that's a neat way to go about it. And plus, I really don't see anything else coming out before Halloween that's going to be anywhere near as scary as this movie is.
All right. Well, next week we have Paranormal Activity 4, so that's going to be the the big one. All right, so those are our three reviews for the week. Let's jump into the box office, why don't we?
Let's see how these movies did.
Let's see how they did. For the second week in a row, Taken 2 is at the top of the list, $22.5 million this week. That brings it up to $86.75 million in 2 weeks. Worldwide, it has $160 million. Not too bad. It's about $60 million short of the first film, but obviously, after only 2 weeks, it's probably going to make its money or surpass that film. At least it looks that way. The movie's still a piece of crap, if you ask me. Number two is Argo, which we just talked about. $20.1 million. It's a couple million dollars short of what The Town did last year, but for a film that's about a historical film, a political film based on the Middle East, I think it's probably a really solid debut.
Especially considering what else came out this weekend and what you think people would go see this time of year.
Right. But I'm curious to see how this movie plays overseas. Like, it hasn't entered a foreign market yet, but I want to see how it does. Like, if it has the same kind of appeal there as it does here. Like, not, to us, it's sort of a novelty, but I want to see how it does for them. So,
yeah, I can't even begin to think. I mean, because for people that already don't have the fondest feelings about America, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it doesn't paint Middle Easterners and Iranians in particular in the best light. So it kind of it's another Team America World Police type skew on it. So I don't know how it'll do over there.
Yeah, it's interesting because Iran is very much in the news, you know, now. So, I'm very curious to see how this goes. The Town actually did really well overseas, which I thought was surprising for you think a film that's so Boston-centric. You wouldn't think it would play outside of the United States, but it did.
He's able to make Boston look so cool that it can, even if you don't know what it is, you're kind of like, oh, that looks like an awesome place, and then you're really surprised when you get there. But, right. Yeah.
Number four is Hotel Transylvania, another $17 million. It's now surpassed the $100 million mark in the States. Number five is another film that came out this week that we're not talking about, and that is Here Comes the Boom, as the Kevin James MMA film, MMA comedy. So you get to watch the fat guy fall on his face a lot, get thrown into cages and stuff. But actually, I've heard the reviews aren't that bad. Our friend Rocky, she gave it, a 3 out of 5 in her review on the site. Mm-hmm. And the cinema score for it is an A+, which means that audiences dug it. You know, audiences really loved it.
Have always liked Kevin James on screen, though.
They do, which is I don't understand it, because I don't really find anything appealing about him at all. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
I liked him on the King of Queens, but I haven't liked him since he kind of took over into movies. I haven't really found much I like about him. And to me, it feels like studios are forever chasing that Paul Blart, you know, gross.
Right.
Now, that
I mean, he was okay
so well.
In Hitch. I didn't mind him too much in there because he kind of played
in Hitch.
The loser guy that didn't know what the hell he was doing pretty well. But, Zookeeper was only on the night. My wife felt like she had to watch it because she loves animals. My wife, who loves animals and stupid comedies, did not like that movie. So that goes to tell you something.
Zookeeper's pretty bad. Number six is Pitch Perfect. It's second week of national release. It's $9.3 million right now, $36.1 total. So that movie's done really well. It's been out for like 4 weeks, but only in national release for like the last 2 weeks. So it's doing really well. A movie that's not doing so well, Frankenweenie, only $22 million total at this point. It's been out for 2 or 3 weeks now. Number eight is Looper, which is up to $51.4 million, doing really well for Rian Johnson. Number nine is Seven Psychopaths, which opened at $4.3 million. This movie doesn't go national for, I think, another couple weeks, but it's doing fairly well in its opening week. Clearly, I thought this movie was marketed to be more of a mainstream action comedy.
Yeah.
You know, In Bruges certainly was not. In Bruges kind of came out of nowhere and surprised people, but this one's not surprising anybody. Everybody's kind of been looking forward to it. And it's already grossed more than half of what In Bruges did here in the States. That movie only made $7 million here. So, yeah. Wow. So Seven Psychopaths off to a good start.
And then our Perks of Being a Wallflower movie we all dig. We just love that game, yep. Dig Dug. Closing out the top 10 with $2 million, $2.1 million total, $6 million.
I wrote that I don't really understand Summit's approach to releasing this film, because it's been out for a month. This is the fourth week it's been out. I don't know if it's going to go beyond this level theatrically. It's only now surpassing 700 theaters at this point. Mm-hmm. And I just don't quite understand this rollout, because the response to it has been really strong. It's got a great young cast that they should be trying to push. I just don't really understand what they're doing. You know, are they going to release it larger next week? This was the week they were going to go wide. So
Seems like a long, like a very slow rollout. I mean, at some point, usually around week three, is when you pump it up to, you know, up to a lot more theaters than it's in now.
Yeah, I'm just really confused. I wrote one more thing on my Tufts of the Box Office post, and this was just me kind of having a little fun, but Atlas Shrugged Part 2 came out this week also. Mm-hmm. And Atlas Shrugged, of course, based on the Ayn Rand book, total piece of shit novel that certain people love. But anyway, the first film for Atlas Shrugged didn't do well at all. In fact, it was one of last year's most high-profile duds. And I remember, I'm going to try not to get too political, but I remember conservatives and libertarians, you know, claiming, of course, that, oh, Hollywood, you know, they unjustly ignored the film, blah, 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 all that kind of crap. So when they started making the sequel, for whatever reason, they thought they could do better with the sequel. They got rid of the cast, got a new director. The producers swore up and down that they would get a much wider release this time for the sequel. And to be fair, he was right. They did get a bigger release. The last film only opened at like 400 theaters. This one opened at over 1,000. What did that extra 1,000 theaters get them? An extra $100,000 in opening weekend.
That does not surprise me one bit.
The last film opened at $1.6 million with considerably fewer theaters, like I said. This one opened at $1.7 million. With 600 more theaters. People just look, the free market, the great open free market that these libertarians love has judged the Atlas Shrugged movies, and the free market does not care about them. So please do not make any more. You have all the evidence you need. Just stop it now.
Well, and I mean, honestly, we've been pretty good about not being political. We can be at it for 30 seconds. Honestly, I mean, everybody else listening, I really think that when stuff like this comes out, you see, because, you know, there are certain subsets of like different groups that go see a movie in force and make it successful, you know, to ridiculous levels. But I think when stuff like happens like this, I'm almost surprised it gets the clout it does, because with today's world of the internet, you know, the militant left or the militant right, it makes up a very small percentage of what it is, but they yell so freaking loud on both sides that it really seems like that when something like this comes out, it's going to be, oh, well, you know, everybody that claims this side or everybody that claims this side is going to be there. But, you know, in actuality, I don't think it's 90% of them don't even agree with the – you know, going in there and seeing some kind of propaganda video. I don't even know what the movie's.
You know my opinion. I don't believe that the terms liberal and conservative mean a hill of beans. They never have. I believe that the vast majority of America is right in the center and doesn't care about labels. But I'd still like to talk to you one day about who exactly the militant left is, because I think that sounds awfully funny.
Well, you're the Salvation Army, right?
Yeah,
that's ironic too. You know,
I know what you mean. It was just a funny term. That's the box office. Let's go into DVDs and Blu-rays this week.
And I have them pulled up this week, so I can actually go through them with you guys. Avatar 3D, hasn't that been out for a long, long time? Why is that on
Avatar? But this is Blu-ray 3D. So this is for, you know, those who had the 3D set up at their house. If I had one, I would get it, because I think this movie looks beautiful in 3D. But unfortunately, I don't.
I still can't believe I rep for this, but the because I will never forget when I first saw a 3D TV It was a Best Buy in their setup, which is supposed to be, you know, the top of the best setup, and it looked like ass. But then my buddy got one with the
vastly improved.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, we watched Avengers on it, and I was blown away.
They look good.
3D TV is kind of silly, I can't lie. Chernobyl Diaries is probably the one I'm most excited about this week.
It was a sick movie. I liked it.
I did too. I just think, you know, radiation monster subjects, you know, whether that's where this movie goes or not, it's implied kind of. So I always thought, ever since Hills Have Eyes, that's always been like an underdeveloped but awesome subgenre for horror, and this is kind of takes the found footage stuff in a different direction. I really enjoyed this movie. I'm looking forward to seeing it again to make sure I still like it.
Yeah, 2016 Obama's America. Speaking of politics, that comes out on DVD this week. It's only $9.99. Now, yeah, that's $9.98 more than it probably should cost, considering it was, you know, pulled out of some guy's ass. But it's there if you want to.
I said 30 seconds of politics. I didn't say that.
If it's there, so if you want to go get it, go get it. Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted. That movie is coming out this week also. God, that movie made a lot of money. All these Madagascar movies make a ton, whether or not they're good or not. I've never seen a single frame of a Madagascar film, and chances are I never will. But I know there'll be a fourth one.
You know what I'm thinking about all the time? That the most entertainment money spent, and it makes sense when you think about it, because I would spend money. It's the smartest way to spend it. Most money spent on entertainment is spent keeping kids busy. So I guess in that sense, it does make sense that Madagascar does make that much money. That's my movie. The movie
that came out this week? Really?
Yes. The movie that really, really, really lost Adam Sandler to me completely. After Jack and Jill last year, I still held on to the man. He developed my childhood. But now he's dead to me. That's my boy.
Moonrise Kingdom comes out this week. This one's an instant buy for me. In fact, I'm in the middle of buying it right now. Moonrise Kingdom, the latest film from Wes Anderson. Really charming, heartfelt film from him. I think the best thing he's ever done. And that includes Rushmore, which I do love. And The Royal Tenenbaums, which doesn't really hold up, in my opinion. But I think this is the best thing Wes Anderson has done, live action style, because he also did Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I thought was really good. So, Moonrise Kingdom, I think, is a must-buy. Anybody who's a fan of Wes Anderson films, and just a fan of coming-of-age stories, I think you want to get that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely worth a rent, if nothing else. A lot of good horror-themed stuff coming out. Terror Train, one of the classic slasher movies, is hitting Blu-ray. Also, for some inexplicable reason, I guess they're trying to get a leg up on the competition. The Santa Claus trilogy, starring Tim Hunt, is on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Mad Men Season 5. I really don't see... Oh, you know what it is awesome that's coming out? Is check it out with Dr. What's his last name? I don't even know what it is. Check it out with Dr. It's the Stephen Brule. Dr. Brule. John C. Reilly's little online internet skit that he did where... I mean, that guy's just so hilarious.
I did not know about this.
Yep, and... I don't know what the hell this is. It must be the original.
Tenchi Muyo box set. Ooh.
The what?
Sorry. Tenchi Muyo.
I just clicked on Gone in 60 Seconds because I had known that movie was on Blu-ray for a long time, and I knew that the Nicolas Cage movie was a remake, but I don't know what the hell this one is. It's H.B. Halicki's original Gone in 60 Seconds, and original is part of the title. I don't know why that is, but it says Car Crash King Edition. It does not look like a movie made in the 60s or 70s, but... out. I don't know what it is, but
it's
you guys
the
buy
original.
That and all other DVDs.
It's just the original Gone in 60 Seconds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a little serious. Looks a little crazy.
Yep. H.B. Blicky directed, and I think he wrote it too.
Yeah.
So.
And other than that, I really don't have anything. I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming out on Blu-ray, like Ella Enchanted, A League of Their Own, a bunch of stuff like that. But as far as new stuff, notable stuff, that's pretty much all I have.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much all I have too. So. So much for that.
Yep. The one thing I did want to mention about Netflix this week on Instant Watcher is I've been waiting since I got Netflix Instant for two TV shows to be released to it for free viewing. That's Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared. They're finally on there, both in their entirety. ATM is on there.
Undeclared.
Did you like those
Undeclared.
Shows?
I'm not the biggest fan of Freaks and Geeks like other people are, but Undeclared... I still think it's the best thing Judd Apatow ever did. It's one of my favorite shows ever. I have it here on DVD. And I haven't had a chance to watch it in the last couple of years, but the last time I watched it, it was just as funny as ever. Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, Charlie Hunnam, great cast all around. Some fantastic cameo appearances by people who would become extremely relevant in the Seth Rogen and Judd Apatow movie world.
Seeing Will Ferrell as a guest star, as a guest starring speed junkie paper writer for college students before he really got famous is a really cool thing to see. Monica Keena, I don't know why. I've always had a thing.
So hot.
Yeah.
She's so hot.
Not so much anymore. She's in a bunch of knockoff movies, but she's in one that looks.
Yeah. She looked like she was going to be something for a while, and she's not.
Yeah.
I can't remember the other girl's name who was the main love interest.
All I remember
her name.
She's
on Bones now.
You know what she was in other than
Carla
that?
Carla Gallo. She played the girl that accidentally got kicked in the nose. I think it was in the 40-Year-Old Virgin, and she was bleeding everywhere.
Oh, no, you're right on that too. I forgot about that one, but she was also in Get Him to the Greek. She's the one that takes Jonah Hill to bed.
Yeah, yeah. She turns up in almost all of the Judd Apatow films in some way. She was the girl who got the period in Superbad. She was dancing. That's Carla Gallo. She was an undeclared. She's got her start there. Now she's on Bones as a recurring character. So yeah, I always liked her a lot. Undeclared is a great film. I mean, a great show.
Yeah.
That everybody should check out.
Great stuff. And there's a bunch of horror movies. I'm not going to take time going through all of them
because
I think I got you with everything last week. Slither and ATM and Priests and Geeks and Undeclared. Go check those out.
It's Halloween, so they're flooding the market with every horror film they can find.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Now, are we in news already?
We're in news.
It's already 8 o'clock. I didn't realize we'd go in an hour.
Yeah.
Okay, nice.
We did 30 minutes of reviews. And we've spent the last 25 minutes doing box office and DVDs. So let's get to the news.
That adds up math-wise. Before we get to the news, let's just say real quick, everybody needs to head over to FunStormCritics.com if you're not, and subscribe to the site. We have right now a giveaway for Paranormal Activity 4 advanced screening tickets. That is going to be the movie of the Halloween season. So if you want to be able to spoil it completely for your friends and see it before they can, go to the site, check it out, sign up there. We have a number of screenings coming up in this next week and even a DVD giveaway that we will be posting in the next couple of days. So make sure to go, make sure to sign up. So not only can you win this stuff, but you can get advance notice of it. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, we're a little bit of favoritism people. We sometimes have secret screenings just for our subscribers. So make sure you sign up.
Yep. Trailers that came out this week, new one for The Impossible. That's the tsunami disaster film with Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. Alter Egos, which is a superhero comedy, coming from Kevin Smith's Smodcast Productions. It actually looks pretty funny. It looks like the kind of film you'd expect Kevin Smith to make with superheroes in it. He's not writing it or directing it, but it looks like something he would have. And my post on it, I actually was surprised that we had never seen a Kevin Smith superhero movie.
I was just about to say that. The closest he's ever got was Bluff Man and Chronic.
Yeah, it's interesting that he's never really done it. And I'm certain that one day it will happen. And I'm hoping like Marvel will give him Daredevil, because Kevin Smith wrote a fantastic Daredevil run that really set that character on a different course, like maybe a decade ago, or maybe a little bit longer than that. Or maybe even Green Arrow, you know? I wouldn't be surprised if he did an episode of Arrow on the WB.
Did you watch that this past week?
I didn't.
I didn't
and then and I tweeted that I wasn't going to watch Arrow because I think Green Arrow was a boring character, and I still do. But I saw the images of Deathstroke the Terminator, who is like one of my favorite villains. And I was like, he looks badass, and I'm going to start watching this show.
Yeah, I was of the opposite. I really wanted to catch it, but I was out that night. And this is a who's who. Like, all of the CW series of the last 7 years, all those background hot, really hot girls that were in it, that and great actresses as well, all those background hot girls are now put into this movie as all the characters. So this is like an amalgamation of CW hotness, number one. And number two, I really thought, looking at the first promo for it, it was going to be crap. But I hear more and more that it's actually good, and I watched a couple of clips, and what I saw I liked, so I'm going to have to check it out. I hope it's not cheesy like Smallville was, because that really wore on me after a while.
Right. No, I hear you, man. All right, so back to the trailers. I got myself sidetracked. A new trailer for Gangster Squad. Warner Brothers is finally reintroducing us to that film. You might remember that it got pushed back all the way to January after the Colorado shooting. The film was, for a while there, it was looking like it might be a potential Oscar contender, but this trailer, to me, I don't think is very good, and I think it might actually be a bad film. I think it looks like it could be terrible, actually, and I think that might be a larger reason why the studio bumped it to January and not so much the Colorado disaster.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think that's the case, but
yeah,
we'll see.
It does seem that way a little bit. I mean, I think we actually talked about this back when they first moved this movie. It's like, I understand, being respectful to it and everything like that, but I think they go to kind of far, like either move the, change the release date or take scenes out.
Movies that they have a lot of confidence and a hell of a lot invested in, they don't move.
Right.
I mean, no matter what happens. I understand the knee-jerk reaction thing, but if they really had high hopes for this movie to do something for the Oscar season, they wouldn't have moved it.
No doubt.
So,
as good as the PR people are in Hollywood, they're not going to stop them from making good billions of dollars if they can.
Right.
And they'll figure out a way around it. They're pretty sadly Hollywood is some of the smartest people in the planet these days. But I'm still excited to see that movie.
I hope it's good. I hope it's good. I really do. Other trailers, a new trailer for Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's Osama Bin Laden film. A much, much better trailer. It looks amazing, actually. Django Unchained, another trailer for that. And I think that was the best trailer for that film as well. We got more of a look at Samuel L. Jackson, a first look at Jonah Hill. And it's just cut totally differently. I mean, it's less rock music, less in your face, and it gives us a little bit more of the plot. So I really dug that trailer for Django Unchained.
Mm.
The new trailer for Hitchcock, that's the film with Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren and Jessica Biel and Scarlett Johansson, based on the making of the film Psycho, looks great. And also the trailer for The Canyons. This is the film with Lindsay Lohan and porn star James Dean, directed by Paul Schrader and written by my man Bret Easton Ellis. The trailer is very interesting. It's very old-school grindhouse exploitation style, which I don't know if the film itself is going to be that way. I don't think it will be, but the trailer is very interesting.
Isn't that like her best shot at anything resembling a career at this point? Is it, she's never going to be an Academy Award winning actress. I think her best shot is to become the next Russ Meyer chick or something like that. You know what I mean?
I don't think the book is written on her yet. I don't think so. She's got she's what, 30, if that?
No, she's like probably 25, maybe 26.
She's got a long way to go. There have been plenty of other people. I mean, shit, we wrote off Robert Downey Jr. a long time ago, too. And look at him now. So I don't want to close the book on her yet. But I think a lot of it's going to depend on what she does with Liz and Dick. That's the movie where she's playing Elizabeth Taylor. If she does a good job on that, and based on what I've seen so far, I think she looks like she could be doing a very good job in it. We could be talking about a potential Emmy nomination for her for that. And if that's the case, I mean, all bets are off. I can see her make a comeback in a big way. Now, doing movies like Scary Movie 5 aren't going to do it, but they're a good way to get yourself out there again. And, and I'm interested in seeing what this movie is actually like. It looks interesting, looks very sexy, erotic. Could be cheesy also, I'm not sure yet. But I'm interested in seeing what The Canyons gives us. And that's it for trailers. A lot of trailers this week. So let's jump into news.
Yes, sir.
You have anything in particular that you want to talk about?
The main thing I want to talk about was the look at the Evil Dead remake.
Right.
Now, we want to talk about freaking creepy looking stuff. Guys, head to the website, check out the first look at the Evil Dead remake, the picture that's at the top there. The original Evil Dead, the stuff never looked, the Deadites, none of it really looked creepy to me ever. I thought it was a neat story. I liked the lore behind it, but this is freaking me. I have it open. I'm looking away. I can't continue to look at this thing. It's freaking creepy. So
And that's Jane Levy. And I mean, that's Jane Levy, the star of the film, looking like that, too. So I don't know what the hell's going on there. But, yeah, the first footage from the Evil Dead remake, directed by Fede Alvarez, debuted at New York Comic Con over the weekend. And the response has been pretty positive. But they also released the first image, which is up on the site now. And basically, it's Jane Levy looking like a deadite and looking rather disgusting and rather hideous. So, like you said, a little scary. So I'm interested because, you know, I was never a huge Evil Dead fan. Like, I like it, but I don't have that reverence for it like a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. This one looks like it's going to be less campy and more like on the nose. So I want to see how that goes, like how that plays.
Evil Dead was always one of those movies that I didn't understand the rest of the horror fan community's love with it. I get it. It was kind of innovative, and it was done on a micro budget, which always adds to stuff. Yep. But really, just wasn't that fun of a movie to watch. I didn't think Army of Darkness is my far and away favorite out of the trilogy.
Right. Well, they might get to that point. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Let's see. Well, what else did you have?
Another week, I'm sure you were going to get to this, but another week, another Captain America Winter Soldier female lead rumor.
Yeah, this one is, the latest rumor has Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who I have a certain fondness for her. She's rumored to play the female lead in Captain America, the Winter Soldier. I've been saying for months that character would be Sharon Carter, the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and niece of Peggy Carter, who was played by Hayley Atwell in the first film. And according to the rumors, that has been confirmed, that the role is for Sharon Carter. So I'll pat myself on the back for that. But anyway, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is up for it. Now, there's still a bunch of other names that are in the mix also. It's like Imogen Poots and Alison Brie and a number of other actresses that were up for it also. So take it with a grain of salt. You know, we don't know what's going to happen yet. We could still be a ways off from knowing what's going to happen with it. But I like Winstead for the role. I think we talked about Teresa Palmer before, that we both liked her for it.
Yes.
But I actually would prefer Winstead, mainly because I think she's a fantastic actress, a better actress than Teresa Palmer is, and she would make a hell of an addition to the Marvel Universe proper. But she also has action experience. I mean, she did Death Proof, and she did The Thing, and she did Sky High when she was younger. I mean, she has a superhero experience
too.
Wasn't
that, wasn't she?
So yeah. So hey, to me, she sounds like a perfect fit.
Yeah. Two out of the three things going on in the sure shots that you put up every week really got my attention. What's your take on? You know, we're saying Columbia Pictures is moving forward with the remake of Masters of the Universe, He-Man.
Right. Yeah.
How do they do that in today's day and age? I mean, it was a far more, not, I don't want to say innocent time in 1987, but you could have a guy wearing a lavender shirt and a blonde bowl cut that didn't come off like a parody of something, if you know what I mean. How do they do that? Like, the picture that's up there, like, I'm looking at in animated form, he looks badass, even though he's wearing a Speedo and some kind of chest protector, whatever you want to call that thing. But
it looks,
how do they do this in the real, like, in modern, for today's audiences?
I don't know, man. I think you just got to go. I think there are two ways to tackle it. You either go dark, you know, make it a little gloomier, which there's certainly the potential for that in Masters of the Universe. It's not all bright and sunny and all that type of shit. It's pretty dark on occasion. Or you just say fuck it and ignore how cheesy it is and tackle it that way. I mean, I there's really the only two ways to do it. And I think if it was up to me, I would just say fuck it and go with some of the cheesier aspects of it. The Prince Adam stuff, you know, some of the villains that are in the film are in the series are kind of corny, and you know, Man in Arms is corny, Ram Man, a lot of those characters are corny. You know, and I think you just go with it. I mean, and just ignore everybody else, because if you get too self-conscious, you're only going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, there,
I mean,
there are.
That's why I look at it with a movie like this.
No, yeah, definitely. And but there are a lot of characters in the Masters Universe, universe, mm-hmm. in the world. Let's just say that that seem silly when you watch because you're watching the cartoon, but really, you make two or three tweaks. Look at is it Trapjaw or Lockjaw?
Trapjaw.
Look at Trapjaw. You make two or three tweaks, that's a scary freaking dude right there.
Oh, yeah, Beastman, too. Beastman could be a tough character, too. Of course, he's the idiot of the bad guys, but, you know, as a creature, he's fairly impressive.
The other thing is we don't really have to talk about it for a second. I just want to say I'm very happy to see that we finally have a bunch of Houdini movies that are going to be coming out soon. He was very extremely interesting subject matter. And that's pretty much I'll let you pull out everything else you want to talk about here. I'm sure you'll cover everything else that I had in mind.
A few things for me. You got the Winstead thing. I was going to talk about that. One thing that I had it looks like Armie Hammer may be back as Batman in the new Justice League movie. A few years ago, when Warner Brothers was first trying to make a Justice League movie with George Miller directing, Armie Hammer was the guy who was going to be playing Batman in it. Of course, the film fell through, but now the rumors are surfacing that they may be looking to bring Armie Hammer back to play Batman. Now, this doesn't mean that he'd be playing Batman in a solo film, just in Justice League, because we don't know if they're going to be doing two separate things or not. We don't know if they're going to be making this into like their own universe, like Marvel did. We don't know that yet. But that's the rumor right now, is that Armie Hammer could be back in the role. It kind of makes sense. You know, he was up for it before. He's a much bigger star now than he was then. And he's also got franchise experience because, you know, the guy is doing the Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp, and he's essentially the lead character. So, I mean, if it happens, hey, that's the biggest step in his career.
There's no doubt in the world that Armie Hammer is one of those actors that is at some point going to be – is basically built to play a superhero. I mean, mm-hmm. He's 6'4".
Oh, yeah. Look at his chin. Look at his face.
But Batman is not a superhero.
Yeah.
I mean, just on the Justice League roster, off the top of my head, I can tell you right now, other people that he'd be more suited for: Flash, Aquaman, Booster Gold, you know, a bunch of different people. Maybe he wouldn't want to take Aquaman. I'm not sure. Yeah, he does not look like a Batman to me. And it's not just that he has blonde hair; he doesn't have the Batman look. I don't know.
Would you have ever said Michael Keaton could play Batman?
I had the foresight. Yes, I would have said no. I'm just kidding. Yeah, probably not. No, you're absolutely right. You know,
I mean, I just
have a lot more than I do. I wouldn't have never said Christian Bale could do it, but
I think there are plenty of heroes that he could probably like if he just took him as he looks right now, he'd be a better fit to play Wally West, the Flash. You know, he'd probably be a better fit for that. But I don't know. I wouldn't want to write him off as Batman. I think he could probably do it. I certainly know he could do the Bruce Wayne part. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know how he could look under the mask, but I imagine if you can make Michael Keaton fit as Batman, you can make anybody fit as Batman.
I guess I always see Batman as like a late 30s, early 40s type person, and he just seems a little too young for it, but. Like Batman Year One, I think he would be a perfect Bruce Wayne, you know. But I just don't—I don't know.
I think they're skewing. I think they're skewing the whole thing younger. So we'll see. So if that's the case, then it would make sense for him to do that. All right, this one I plucked out for you because I know your love of Jean-Claude Van Damme and Bloodsport. A few weeks ago, and I know we talked about it on the show. We talked about Jean-Claude Van Damme wanting to be in the Bloodsport remake that was coming out. We did talk about that, right?
Indeed.
And I think I said it, and you probably agreed with me, that Jean-Claude Van Damme essentially calling out the writer was not a smart idea.
No.
Because remember, he was like, oh, the writer, he wants all the credit for himself, so he's not going to let me in. And remember, he essentially said that?
Yeah.
We were that's not smart.
Yeah. The guy, he wasn't lost for 10 years because he can't act. He wasn't not being picked up for movies because he couldn't perform in them anymore. Because he's an asshole. He's always been. He had an alcohol problem. He never got under control. Maybe he has it under control now, but he still thinks he's one of those people that thinks he's owed something. And he doesn't understand the fact that, hey, you know, if something doesn't work out right away, maybe you should just try harder. He just gets pissed and yells at everybody and then burns all his bridges.
It's like what we said, Ben. He sees his fellow 80s compatriots, Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, have a ton of franchises under their belt. They're Hollywood icons. They're still starring in multiple movies per year, even now, and well into their 60s. And he's still making Universal Soldier straight to DVD. You know, he sees that around him, and it obviously bothers him.
He should around him, though, is in the in the media, like in their personal lives. All those guys you mentioned, Willis, Schwarzenegger, right now with Schwarzenegger, but in Stallone, you know, they come off as like macho men, but they're also, you know, cool guys, it seems like.
Well, Schwarzenegger Despite all the issues he's had that have been in the media, Schwarzenegger still comes off as like a nice guy.
Yeah, he does. And Van Damme, at best, he comes off as skeezy, you know, as sleazy, I mean. He comes off as a guy that, you know, might grab your girlfriend's butt if he was drunk and behind your back. You know, he just never rubs anybody the right way.
Well, anyway, the writer has actually responded now. The writer was Robert Mark Common, who actually wrote Taken 2. He also wrote Taken. So he's kind of, you know, big shit right now. And he came out and he talked about it. And here's his quote in regards to Bloodsport, or at least Jean-Claude Van Damme being in it. This film resembles the original in title only. I wanted to emphasize that point for you, John. This film resembles the original in title only. It has nothing to do with any Kumite contest. It has nothing to do with Frank Dukes. If the title was not the same, you would not associate the two films. Ugh. To use JCVD would make no sense because the association would be lost as the story has nothing to do with the first one. If anything, it would be a distraction. And then he goes on to say, no splits in the Bloodsport remake. This is a character-driven, politically motivated film. It has nothing to do with splits or muscles or grudge matches. And as I said, if the title were not attached to the rights, you would not associate one film with the other. That last part to me was, I thought, an intentional dig at Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah.
You know, which I thought was a little classless and, you know, unprofessional. But the main thing for me, and I understand what he's saying. If the movies aren't going to be related, then yes, Jean-Claude Van Damme would be a distraction. He's the writer. To the best of our knowledge, Philip Noyce is still the director. It's up to them. They don't want to use him, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it pisses me off that they're calling the movie Bloodsport, presented it initially, as if it was going to be a remake of Bloodsport, and now come out now and then say, oh, they two have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, you know, it's how hard it can be for me to stop words from flying out of my mouth uncensored sometimes. I was trying to make sure I let you finish the story without interrupting, because what you just said, it was boggling my mind as you were talking. He comes out like a pompous ass, the writer does, and he says straight up, well, you know, to put JCVD in it would be misleading. It would be confusing to the audience. Well, you know what else would be? Naming it Bloodsport, you ass clown.
Exactly. Exactly.
that might be a problem as well. And don't even try to tell me, well, I can name my movie this.
He
it
can't
wasn't intentional.
He can't blame fans for expecting Jean-Claude Van Damme, or at least for expecting martial arts, if you're going to call the movie Bloodsport. I mean, you can't – it just doesn't make any sense, you know? So it just makes me mad.
That'd be like if Man of Steel came out and it was actually about steelworkers.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Ridiculous.
It doesn't make any sense. So that really pissed me off earlier this week when that came out.
Yeah.
I only have one other thing, and this is more television than anything else. But over the weekend, we learned that Agent Coulson from the Avengers, he's back. Clark Gregg, you know, rather horribly died in the Avengers. And fans have been wanting to find a way for Agent Coulson to come back in some way. Some people thought he was going to come back as an android Vision, which I always thought was a little silly. And other people just said, and this seemed more logical to me, was that he might have been a life model decoy, which S.H.I.E.L.D. uses for all their higher-ups. You almost never will see, like Nick Fury anywhere. Like, it's almost always a life model decoy in case somebody tries to kill him. And more often than not, somebody does try to kill him. And so people kind of assume that it might have been a life model decoy for Agent Coulson. We don't know what the reason is, but whatever the case, Joss Whedon and Kevin Feige revealed that Agent Coulson will be back for the S.H.I.E.L.D. television series. He will be the lead character in that series, actually. So that's pretty awesome. I'm glad to have him back because I love Agent Coulson in the films. And I think this, more so than anything else we've heard so far, ensures us that the TV series is very much going to cross over with the movies.
Yeah. My first reaction to this was, you can't do that with today's audiences, because the non-comic book people will be turned off. They won't, like, when life model decoy, what the hell? But I almost started thinking that, and then I realized it was Marvel, and I've learned to stop doubting because they know how to handle this stuff without alienating non-comic book fans, and I think this is the smartest way to go because Coulson, it kind of almost probably sucked for them because, you create this monster of a character that's become such a beast of its own in this movie full of huge personalities and powers, and this is a guy in a suit with kind of dry humor every 30 minutes or so and just business after that. You never expect that guy to be super popular with everybody in the audience. And you have such an amazing actor in the role, an amazing character that's already been built up. It would really suck for him just to go out like that. So that is definitely good news to me.
Coulson's cool because he's just the regular guy in this world of crazy powers and stuff like that. And he's not like Fury. Fury doesn't seem affected by it. You know what I mean? That's one of the reasons why people love Nick Fury, but Coulson is the guy who's like us, who's like, wow, at all this shit. Yeah, he tries to keep it cool, but more often than not, he's blown away by all the shit that's going on around him. So he's kind of like our eyes through all this stuff that's going on. So, it always was strange to me when they killed him. I was kind of blown by it. I was like, wow, really?
Yeah.
But obviously, I'm happy to have him back.
Well, I do have to say, at least when they did kill him, I as pissed as I was, at least they didn't make it for nothing. They made him the catalyst for the team coming together. So that worked for me. Only other real thing I really want to talk about was just real quick, not even really talk about, but just say how cool they were. Is all these posters coming out of New York Comic Con, in particular the poster for Schwarzenegger's Last Stand. I was just talking to somebody about these kind of posters the other day, and I was saying, why don't they do those cool hand-drawn posters anymore?
Did you see all those posters for The Man with the Iron Fist that came out this week? It was like 16 of them, all hand-drawn, all by different artists. They look amazing.
Yeah, that's right. They're starting to come back, it seems, because we have those, and then we have this Last Stand, which this is kind of like, I'm guessing, like it's just an art thing for Comic-Con, but that's like a lost relic of Hollywood that I'm glad to see starting to come back. Because these crappy photoshops that they're putting together, movie posters, as silly as it sounds, used to be part of the whole thing. It's part of the pageantry. So I was glad to see that. But that's just a little thing I want to say.
Yeah. They got all those Mondo posters that come out now and all that stuff. So, like you said, posters do seem to be coming back. They are in style again. That's it for news for me. And I think that just about wraps it up for us. Next week, Paranormal Activity 4 is probably the big movie we'll be talking about. Alex Cross, which is the rather ridiculous-looking movie with Alex with Tyler Perry in the role made famous by Morgan Freeman in Kiss the Girls and Along Came a Spider, and featuring a really ripped Matthew Fox.
I don't even think really, ripped really, is. I think this is a really invented new word for it.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't even seem to really do it justice, does it?
Yeah, it seems like, oh, you know what it seems like? Like he not only he lost all the fat on his body, but somehow he made his skin thinner so that you can see more of his fucking muscles.
He looks like he was chiseled out of holy marble.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like and also, I really want to talk about Smashed, which is the alcoholism drama starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. Fantastic film. I want to talk about that. It's been kind of on the festival circuit all year, but it's finally making its debut, and I think people are going to be surprised by it and by the stars in it because they're fantastic. So definitely want to talk about that. And I think that's it. I think that's it for next week. So those would be the three big movies for next week.
Yeah, we might even do some brainstorming. We know we haven't. It's been you and me for a long stretch now, longer than we've done in a while. So maybe we'll see if one of our buddies wants to come in and chat about something with us. We'll get something mixed up for you. But
maybe we'll bring our friend Tim Gordon in here to talk about Alex Cross, because
you know what?
We tend to have a similar viewpoint when it comes to Tyler Perry, and I want to get his opinion on this very different venture for him.
Yes.
So that'd be interesting.
And that opinion, by the way, folks, is that they both love him.
Yes.
No, but yeah, Tim hasn't been on in a while. I feel neglected. So we'll have to get him on here. But until then, folks, make sure to check out PunchDrunkCritics.com every single day. You're missing out if you don't. If you're in the D.C. area, we have local advanced film screenings every single week, it seems like. And we're starting to get more and more things to give away for you. I know we'll have at least one DVD to give away this week. So check out there. Subscribe to the newsletter. We're not spamming you. We're trying to hook you up here. Facebook, search for us, Punch Drunk Critics. Become a fan. We're almost at 1,100. We would really like to reach that. So if you guys can help us out, maybe we'll do something special then. Oh, yeah. Questions, comments, or suggestions? PunchDrunkCritics@gmail.com or yahoo.com. On Twitter, Travis is at Punchy Critic. I am at Punch Drunk John. And I feel like I'm missing an avenue of communication here. Did I miss?
No, I think that's it. Facebook, Twitter. I mean, we're in other places, but those are the main ones. So yeah, that's it.
And guys, we don't say it enough on here. Make sure to check out Travis on Weeda's Around Town, and also in the Washington Examiner if you're in the Washington D.C. area.
Thank you.
The other thing we have to talk about is nothing, because Walking Dead is coming on in 1 hour, and
yes.
I'm going to watch it.
You know what's cool that I just found out? The Angelica Mosaic here is playing them on the big screen every week.
Are you kidding me?
No. And their tickets are free. You just got to get there on time. You got to get there early.
I won't be able to make it every week, but I'm damn sure going to be there for the finale. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, they sent out the email about it a couple of days ago. Yeah, they're first come, first serve.
Oh man. Okay. Yeah. Well, we might have an earlier show a couple of weeks so I can get all the way up to freaking Virginia. Guys, have a good week. Check it out the site every day. We'll see you next Sunday.
Later.
See ya.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.